Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Our friend R.C. Christensen, author of the book The Border Boys, joins us in the Pigpen once more for some more great Canadian football history. And this time he shares his knowledge with some info from his book about pro football north of the border decades prior to the CFL. It's all coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome back to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we have a great peer through the portal of history today as we get our friend, author R.C. Christensen, wrote that great book, The Border Boys. He was on about a month ago talking about a little bit of Canadian football and some football near the border where he lives up in North Dakota. He's going to go into some more detail on the Canadian side of professional football, especially early pre-CFL, and we'll bring him in right now. R.C. Christensen, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Ah, great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, R.C., we had quite a lot of correspondence from our listeners on your last visit here, so I'm very excited when you started talking earlier this week and about, you know, coming on again and talking about this great Canadian football pre-CFL in the professional ranks. So I'm very interested to hear some of this history and what you have to say. And this is all contained within your book, The Border Boys, correct?
Yes. If you've read Border Boys, you'll see that this is kind of a tangent sort of that takes place in the book. But by the end of the book, you realize why I go into it, because the what the book is following is this weird time in Canadian football when a lot of the teams were behaving professionally, but officially they were still amateur.
Okay, so this is a little bit of a tease into the book and a section of the book. And for those that haven't read the book yet, and I'm sure they're going to be very interested after this conversation, why don't you give them a shout out where they can get Border Boys right now, and we'll say it again at the end, and we'll also have it in the show notes.
Sure. One of the great things you can do is go to borderboysbook.com, and there I've got a lot more information about the book. And also it's available in lots of different online bookstores. So I mean, you know, Amazon is where it's published through, but I've seen it at Barnes and Noble and multiple other places. So it's out there.
Okay, great. And we'll remind the audience again at the end. And again, it's on the show notes. We'll have it in there so you can click through. Don't worry about writing it down right now. Just go to your show notes during this as you're listening, and you can have a link to go right to RC's great website. So where do we want to begin on this this great story?
Well, let me just sort of set the scene. So what we have is Canadian football had just grown into this game that was much more like the American game. So starting in the 1930s, they finally had the forward pass. And what teams, especially in Western Canada, were doing, were bringing in American college players to their former college players to play on their teams, and so that they could compete more with the teams in the East, because the teams in the East, you know, there was more population in the East. A lot of people from Western Canada, they would go to college in the East, and then they would join club teams in the East after college, and they would play football there. So a lot of the talent was concentrated in the East. But the West really wanted to, you know, make a name for themselves. And so they started bringing in Americans across the border and paying them. And of course, they were paying them with, quote unquote, Christmas gifts, and, you know, finding them jobs and other things like that. And so And so there was this professionalism going on, but it, officially they were still amateur clubs, and that was a big controversy at the time.
Okay. So they, I assume that the Canadian amateur status was similar to that here in the States, where, you know, once you're paid, you're no longer an amateur. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so they, everything was under the table, and they, you know, they sort of kept track of those amateur cards across the border and everything. And so, it, you know, it didn't matter where you had played any kind of professional game or sport of any kind. It spoiled you, so to speak, for playing in the Canadian football ranks.
Okay, so I wondered, were there some of the using the pseudo names and you know, false names so you wouldn't get in trouble? Was that taking place in Canada like it was in the U.S.?
That was, and actually that wasn't something I planned to talk about, but I'll mention it here. There was one individual named I'm trying to remember. I think it might have been the Texas Longhorns. He was named Bon Hilliard, and he used the name of someone that he knew from a different university down there, one of the universities down in Oklahoma. And he went up to Canada and played under that other guy's name. And and then so they found out that he wasn't playing under the real name that he was. And then also he had played some minor league baseball in the United States before he went up to Canada. So it became a problem. So that was one example where that was going on. But what I want to talk about today, the impetus was that for this was, you had a previous podcast that talked about this individual named Lionel Conacher, and, he actually played in, you said that, you know, it was the focus was hockey, but he played multiple sports. He played football in Canada, and he played lacrosse and a baseball player. He was a boxer, wrestler, and of course hockey, and then also track and field. And so he was quite an athlete. And as a matter of fact, he's in several halls of fame. He also, the Lionel Conacher Award is now the Male Athlete of the Year Award up in Canada. So this guy was seen as, you know, the quote unquote Jim Thorpe of Canada. He was quite the guy.
Yeah, that's sort of what attracted me to him. I was doing a piece on hockey over on jerseydispatch.com, and we did a podcast on it on Sports Jersey Dispatch on Conacher as a hockey player, because we're trying to, you know, cover some of the legends of hockey, as we always are there for team sports. And I kept seeing this name, you know, like you said, the Canadian Jim Thorpe, and just seeing all these, you know, athletic events that he was in and was successful at. It was really quite amazing. And it's a very interesting individual in history.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things he did was he had played football for the Toronto Argonauts, and it led them to a Grey Cup championship in 1921. And then after that, he played professional hockey. And and then, of course, that disqualified him from playing football in Canada anymore. But then the Big Four, as they called it, the Interprovincial Rugby Football Union up in Canada, and it still had rugby in the name, but it was the football, the Big Four teams there in the East. They disqualified actually two players from the Ottawa team because they found out they had played professional baseball. And this, for some reason, this sort of really ticked off Lionel Conacher, and he decided that, you know what, that's just not fair. That's just not right. And so he decided that, hey, I think here in Eastern Canada, we should have some outright professional football teams. In other words, we're not going to hide this anymore. We're going to play pro football, and we're going to say so, and we're going to pay the people. And so he decided that he should manage and coach and then also play on a pro football team in Toronto. And he quote unquote, he said, professional football is going ahead by leaps and bounds in the United States, and we intend to have a shot at it.
Okay, so we're in the middle of the 1930s, so we're about, you know, 13, 14 years of the NFL APFA's existence. So he's probably monitoring that and seeing that, you know, that's starting to grow a little bit and getting him a little bit of angst, and he's, you know, nuts and nervous over, you know, these players losing their amateur status, and they want to play some football, and he does too. So that's some great motivation there to get professional football started in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so of course everything, especially back then, and it still happens now, but you know, everything sort of starts out with a big vision, right? And so the big vision was there was going to be this pro league with teams in Toronto and Montreal. And then they were going to have all these, they were going to find American teams to be members. and that was the plan. Okay. And so what Conacher did was, or what I should say, what happened was, is there ended up being two teams in starting in 1933 in Canada, and they didn't actually have a relationship. Even though I think Conacher was talking to the Montreal people at the time, they never did play one another. So there was a team in Toronto and there was a team in Montreal, and they each kind of went their own way with a professional team in 1933, playing the game differently even. So to explain Toronto's side of things, they played with Canadian rules. Of course, that was 12 men and three downs to get 10 yards. And then, but they modified it because in the Canadian rules, you weren't allowed to block. I think it was past at that time, 3 yards. You could block up to 3 yards beyond the line of scrimmage, and you couldn't block anymore. And you also could not block on kick returns. But Conacher said, no, we're going to play where we're going to allow blocking up to 10 yards from the line of scrimmage, and then you can block all you want on kick returns. So, you know, he bonafied it. And at that time, there was a lot of, it was interesting because there was a lot of push in Western Canada to do those things that he would wanted to implement. And so it was almost like he was sort of going to test that out or something. And he got a sponsor. It was the Cross and Blackwell Foods brand. And they sponsored the team, and he called them the Chefs. But the interesting thing is, if I think it's, even if you look at the Canadian Football Hall of Fame page for Lionel Conacher, the picture they have of him, because it's probably the best picture they have of him in playing football, he's actually wearing his Cross and Blackwell jersey. he's not wearing the Argonauts jersey. So so they actually have his one-off pro team represented in the picture for in the Canadian Football Hall of Fame.
I know what everybody's thinking. If they're thinking like me, having a name like the Chefs, it's bringing up that commercial from probably about a decade ago where the officials out there ready to flip the coin and Kansas City Chiefs are playing somebody, and he forgets the coin, and then at the end of the commercial, the same guy misspells the word Chiefs and spells Chefs in the end zone. So there was a real Chefs team, like, professional team.
He says something like, "Oh, googly moogly," or something.
Right.
Yeah. I know that. I know that commercial well. So, anyways, Conacher, he was again player, coach, and manager of this team in Toronto, and he brought on some characters like his brother, who also played hockey, Charlie Conacher. He went to play on his football team. Then the other two big names on that team were a guy named Joe Savoldi, and he had played at Notre Dame on their undefeated teams of 1929 and 1930. And then, of course, the way things were back then, you know, he was at a Catholic college, and he had gotten married and divorced while he was there at Notre Dame, and that was a big scandal. See, so they forced him off the roster before the end of the 1930 season, and then he actually played for the Chicago Bears for the rest of that season. And then after that, he became Jumping Joe, a professional wrestler. And then there was one other guy. His name was Chief McLean, and he was a big fullback from the Haskell Institute. And he had played in the NFL for the Portsmouth Spartans and also the Staten Island Stapletons. So those were kind of the big characters that Conacher brought him to his team.
So, he infused it not only with the college players, but some former NFL players, which probably helped, you know, the credibility of professionalism, you know, in his team, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it would be interesting to know, where did he, you know, come across these guys, you know? I wasn't able to find that part out, but it's kind of interesting. It's kind of like, how did he decide that these guys were going to play for him, you know? So, and then Montreal had a team, and it's really interesting because Montreal's team was put together by the ownership group for the Montreal Canadiens hockey team at the time. And so they decided, oh yeah, yeah, we'll do a football team as well. And they even more heavily recruited from the professional wrestling people. The interesting thing was, is their team was mostly New Englanders, and actually the team, as we would find out later, they all lived in Boston. They all practiced in Boston. And then when they'd go to their home games, so to speak, in Montreal, you know, they'd have to travel to Montreal to play. So, you know, these are all New Englanders that these guys hired. And they hired three former Olympic athletes, all of whom had been wrestlers in the Olympics. But they'd also played football at either in college or in the NFL. Like, for example, there was Jack Spellman, who played for the Providence Steamroller in the NFL for 6 years. And then also the Boston Braves. And then there was Charlie Strack. And he had played with the Chicago Cardinals. And so, and then Earl McCready, and all three of those guys, the Olympic wrestlers, they were also professional wrestlers. Earl McCready was Earl Moose McCready. Jack Spellman, I think he just went by his own name. And then there were some other guys too. There was a guy named Tony Ciano. He had played with Charlie Strack at the Chicago Cardinals. There was a Jim Wallace, who had played with the Boston Bulldogs in the AFL, Red Grange's AFL in 1926. Another guy named Bibber McCoy. He was a much more prominent pro wrestler, and he actually went by several different names. He went by El Toro, Green Hornet, Red Raider, Taurus the Bull. And so those are the players that ended up on that Montreal team, and their coach then. He was the general manager, and they called the team out of Montreal the Mount Royals. And their manager then was Shag Shaughnessy. And Shag Shaughnessy was a longtime football coach at McGill up there. Yes, he was a longtime football coach at McGill University in up there in Montreal. And but he was also... He also ran the Montreal Royals minor league baseball team. And so he was going to be in charge of these Mount Royals as well.
Yeah. It's amazing that, you know, McGill, if those listeners remember, you know, back in early football in the stocking cap era, McGill University is the one, and I'm sure Shag Shaughnessy was a part of them then, but were the ones that brought sort of the idea of some of the concepts of football to Harvard, and Harvard transferred them to some of the other schools, Yale and Princeton and that. But that's how Walter Camp got some of his ideas, is from McGill's University and the brand that they were playing. So McGill really has a lot of involvement in football in a lot of different ways. That's amazing.
Well, and Shag Shaughnessy, when he was at McGill, he was really controversial to all the other football teams that they played against, because Shag Shaughnessy was doing innovations by catch your breath, using linebackers, you know, just little things that we just take for granted nowadays. He was bringing into the game up there, and he was a proponent of the forward pass for a long time, many years before they ever started doing it up in the Canadian football. But one of the things that's real interesting here is I need to mention is the uniform. The Mount Royals wore the colors of the Montreal flag. And so they had cardinal red pants and white socks. And then they had white jerseys that had a red diamond over the heart. And then they had black numerals. And so to me, it almost, you know, at first thought, it's almost like a jester's, you know, like a court jester type uniform is what it reminds me of. So it'd be neat to, if there would, I couldn't find a picture of it, but I did find a description.
Probably finding a picture is one thing. Finding a colored picture of it from that era might be a whole nother trick.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, but so, yeah, so those were the two professional teams. And so, and of course, they did play out some of a schedule. The Toronto Cross and Blackwell Chefs, as they were called, they played a team called the Rochester Arpicos. And the Arpicos, they were in the New York State Football League. They were sponsored by the Rochester Packing Company. And Arpicos was actually the name of their meat products. And so that's where they got the name Arpicos. So you had the chefs playing the meat products in that game. And they had a, their big player was a guy named Greg Swartout. And he was from Dartmouth College. And that first game, and so you can say that the first professional game, officially professional game of football in Canada was played between the Toronto Cross and Blackwell Chefs and the Rochester Arpicos. And it was, and this was out of every game what we're going to talk about, this was the biggest one in terms of fans. They had 13,000 fans there. They were all excited to see Lionel Conacher because they knew all about him, right? Because he was a kind of a, he was a Canadian hero, right? Lionel Conacher, you know, was said to have been about 90% of the offense for Toronto, but his Cross and Blackwell Chefs, they lost though 18-15 to the Arpicos. So they did lose to the Rochester team.
Now, RC, do you know what? So they were, Toronto was playing by Canadian rules. Is that what they played in this game? Because I'm sure Rochester was probably playing by more of American rules with the four downs.
Well, they played the whole game, though, by those Canadian rules I mentioned earlier. So they played by the 12 man and the three downs for 10, and then also the adjusted blocking rules. Yeah.
Well, that's even more amazing that Rochester was able to win. You know, yeah. It could be a challenge. I'm sure it's a whole different strategy losing a down. That's be difficult, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. okay. So then they played a, so it was like a, what do you call that? When they go back to the other teams,
the home and home series,
home and home game. Right. So they played at Red Wing Stadium in Rochester then. And there they only had 1,000 fans, only 1,000 people even cared, like, why do we want to watch this? So, but they got 1,000, not 13,000. And the Arpicos won again. They won 12-6. And so, in that home and home, we get to the Montreal team. And now, what I failed to mention before is Montreal did not play by the same rules as what Toronto was doing. It was really interesting. Montreal decided we're going to play by NFL rules, and we're going to play by NFL rules, but we're going to add the Canadian rouge a point to it. And so it was just, you know, NFL rules at the time in 1933, which was interesting because I can't remember if it was 32 or 33 when the NFL changed their forward pass so that you could pass from anywhere behind the line of scrimmage instead of having to be 5 yards back.
I think that was 1933 when they broke away from the NCAA rules and created their own rule book. It was sometime in there because the first like 12 years they played with the NCAA rules in the NFL.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So they were playing by those rules, you know, and then, but then they added the rouge.
Interesting Montreal, twist.
Yeah. But of course, remember Montreal had former NFL players on it. Right. So, I suppose they were like, hey, sure. Why not? And so they played a team called the Portland Arrows. And of course the Portland Arrows out of Maine, you know, they had to travel to Montreal, but so did Montreal's team, right? Because they were in Boston. So they both traveled to Montreal. There was about 5,000 spectators for that first game. And then the Montreal team beat Portland. So they won that game. And afterward, it was, as far as like the reviews and things afterward, it was sort of mixed, because the Montreal Gazette said, hey, it was great to see that they left the showmanship of the wrestling mat behind them in the dressing room. Okay. But that wasn't completely true, or it was just seen differently, because there was another newspaper, the Montreal Daily Herald, that was saying that they were sort of making more of a circus. They sort of wrote it more like a circus story, I suppose, because, you know, here was these wrestlers. And so they sort of made fun of the wrestlers and suggested that it was more of a show. Okay. And then in the United States, they picked up on that. They picked up on the Montreal Daily Herald's report about it being more like a show, like, you know, what we'd think is WWE type stuff nowadays, right? And that it was more of a put on. And so there was these sort of conflicting reports about that game. And I don't think that helped Montreal at all, because it seems like, as I'll talk about a little bit, it seems like it hurt them in the short run.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd probably lose a lot of credibility, especially with American fans, that, and they're playing American teams. That might be part of the reason why the turnout was poor on the American side. And, you know, I'm sure the NFL probably ate that up, because, you know, they were in competition with a lot of different leagues, and, you know, they probably didn't want to have another one to compete with. They wanted to be like they are today, you know, the dominant force in the world of football.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when they played that game in Montreal, because remember, they played by NFL rules up there, the fans didn't know what to do with it. they didn't understand the rules at all, you know, because it wasn't modified Canadian rules like what they were doing in Toronto. It was NFL rules, and so they were just confused. And so there wasn't a great reception there up in Montreal. Now, after that game, Montreal was supposed to play another team, and this would have been a great game, or at least it would have been interesting to find out how it ended up. They were scheduled to play a team called the Père Marquette Knights. And a lot of people don't know about the Père Marquette Knights. And I think, gosh, I would love it if someone wrote a book about them, but they're the Knights of Columbus team from Boston, and it's the Père Marquette, whatever you call it, their lodge or whatever, right? That's the name of their organization. But they had played, they had a long history of playing NFL teams, whether they were future, current, or former teams. Whenever they played them, they played the Hartford Blues, the New York Giants, Providence Steamroller, Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, Cleveland Indians, the Orange Tornadoes, you know, so, I mean, I've had New York Giants in there, right? So, I mean, they played some significant games, and so they were pretty important. But it didn't happen, because just that year, their coach of 7 years resigned, their manager of 17 years resigned, and they lost their home field, and it just didn't happen. So I'm disappointed it didn't happen, because that would have been interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It looked like they were going to play half of the NFL at the time, almost. Yeah. Some of those mostly Eastern teams. So that would have been interesting.
Yeah. So then Montreal did end up playing a team called the Philadelphia Trojans. And to me, it seems almost like it was sort of a team that was thrown together for the contest. I couldn't figure out that they'd actually been anything else besides playing that one game. It's possible they were something else, and I just couldn't find out. But that game that they played was only 1,000 fans, but it's because the rain was steady and the teams played under inches of water. I mean, it's like they basically played in a lake. And so it was just a disappointing game overall. And so in a lot of ways, that was kind of the end of the Montreal Mount Royals. What happened was, all of a sudden, you get these guys from the Montreal Canadiens talking about, oh, next year we're going to do even more. We're going to have this international professional football league. And then And then they said, oh, and we're going to play the remainder of our schedule south of the border because of the bad weather up here. And we have all these teams lined up. And they mentioned Providence Steamrollers, Staten Island Stapletons, games in Atlantic City. They said all this stuff was going to happen. And then supposedly there was going to be a team in Ottawa that was going to join. But I don't know if they, you know, again, they, you know, a lot of times these promoters would just, they would just, you know, shoot for the sky. And then it just really fell flat, because what they ended up doing is they sent the team back to the United States, like they said they were going to, but then they just sort of disowned them. It doesn't appear that that team, the Mount Royals, ever played any of those teams that they mentioned, but they did. They did go on to play at least two more games, though, under a different name, the Bone Crushers.
Well, that brings a little bit more fear into the game, that's for sure, for opponents.
Well, and you know, remember, there's these NFL players and former pro wrestlers on that team, and it's almost like after the sort of bad press they were getting, you know, remember the Montreal Daily Herald and was talking about how it was more of a performance, and then the U.S. picked up on it. It's almost like they decided, okay, well, if that's what you think we are, that's what we're going to be. Because then they scheduled a game against the Lowell Indians in Lowell, Massachusetts, at Laurier Park. And there was several hundred spectators. The game was in the snow, but the Bone Crushers, as they called themselves, they had the Masked Marvel at quarterback. So I'm guessing it was, you know, a wrestler wearing his wrestling mask playing quarterback. And of course, they were still wearing the Mount Royals uniforms. And so remember, I said these uniforms sort of remind me, in my mind at least, of these court jesters. So I suppose that really worked for their theme, right? Here they are, these pro wrestler style guys with the Masked Marvel, and they're the Bone Crushers. And they actually did do a pro wrestling style show at halftime. They pretended to come back out to play wearing skates and skis, and they had a choreographed argument between the coach and the referee. But they actually played, I guess, because they did beat the Indians 12-0.
Well, it sort of played right into their critics' hands of, you know, not giving them credibility and saying, you know, it's a put on show, you know, like, you know, wrestling as opposed to, you know, gridiron football. So maybe that was, didn't help them out too much, I'm sure.
Yeah. And then I guess they play, there was one last game that you could count as being a Mount Royals type game, because the Bone Crushers did play one more game. That report, though, didn't mention Mount Royals at all, but it clearly was the same team. And they played on Thanksgiving Day against the Medford Athletic Association in Boston. And I did the report, though, didn't even say who won. So, but that was sort of the, I don't know, the disappearance of this team that had this sort of performance reputation, took it to heart, and then just disappeared. So, but it reminds me of, you know, when I first ran across this with the Bone Crushers and the pro wrestlers, I immediately thought of XFL.
Yeah, you're right. The wrestling running football. So yeah, you got a point there.
Yeah. But Toronto wasn't done, right? So Toronto played yet another game. They played a team called the Buffalo Bison. The Buffalo Bison seemed like another team that was sort of put together for the contest. I couldn't figure out that they'd actually played anywhere else. It's quite possible they did, but I didn't find anything. And you know, it wasn't well attended, but Toronto did win that game. So that was the end of the 1933 season. There was one more season then that Lionel Conacher took his Toronto team to the field professionally. And so in 1934, he came out his team, but they were called something else. They were called the Wrigley Aeromints, after the William Wrigley Jr. Company chewing gum manufacturer. So they were the chewing gum team.
They seem to like their food products then, huh?
Yeah, right. Well, this is the after meal food product, apparently. But he, the whole, you know, fantasy about a big league starting up in Canada for professional teams just sort of fell by the wayside. He said they were going to play professionally, but he actually got some promotional help from Leo Dandurand, who was the managing director for the Montreal Canadiens. So they were actually still involved in some way. So they were helping with promotion. And he, you know, he brought in some other interesting characters to play on his team. And one of them was a pro wrestler called Ernie the Beast Zeller, who'd played for Indiana State. And then also he brought in a former first base coach and a pitcher for the former, the defunct Toronto Ostlers baseball club. And the people in Toronto knew this guy because he would entertain the crowd between innings with juggling and comedy routines. And so, you know, so there's this sort of weird element again on the team where you had this guy that the crowd sort of expected to be a clown. Right. And so then the Arrowmints played the Rochester Oxfords, and the Oxfords were a semi-pro team in the Sandlot circuit there in Rochester, New York. They had actually played the Buffalo Bisons, the NFL Buffalo Bisons in 1929. And so they were actually kind of a significant team at one point. And so these two teams played. The Conacher's Arrow Mints walked away with the win. But during that game, there was a situation where that Hap Watson, who was the juggler clown guy, his pants kept falling off as he's playing. And so, you know, I don't know. Was it on purpose?
You can't make this stuff up, can you?
No. So, you know, anyways, you know, it's funny to think about, right? You know, was it on purpose or whatever? Anyways, so they played that game, and then they played another game against a team they called Buffalo. Not a whole lot is known about them, but there was a lot of passing in that game. And the Toronto Daily Star afterward said that neither players nor fans appeared to be the least accustomed to the rules. So the Buffalo team seemed pretty baffled by Conacher's modified Canadian rules. And then after that, the former CRU Canadian Rugby Union president, which is the organization, Canadian Rugby Union, again, it's rugby in the name, but it's the organization that oversaw football in Canada. And he said that, well, professional football is dead on arrival. And so, you know, but the Arrowmints did play one more game. They played the Tonawanda Pros. And, you know, there was a team in the NFL called the Tonawanda Cardets. And so Tonawanda is like one of those almost like a suburb or another city there right next to Buffalo, right? And a lot of Sandlot teams. And then Conacher didn't even play in that game. And so, you know, they didn't get very good turnout there. It was played in Montreal, actually. They didn't get very good turnout. But the Arrowmints did beat Tonawanda in that game as well. And so that was the end of professional football in Canada until, you know, the teams in Canada, like I said, they played sort of under the table professionalism for quite a long time. And then it became more official after World War II. But then, of course, the CFL started in 1958. And then that was gosh darn official professional football in Canada. But yeah, we had this kind of weird little episode in 1933 and 1934, where we had these teams playing professional football in Canada just to kind of make a point. And, you know, that professional football in Canada could be successful, and it actually didn't turn out to be so successful.
You know, one thing that comes to my mind, I mean, it's a great story. One thing that keeps coming up in my mind, and you're hearing, like, you know, the Montreal Canadiens organizations involved in this, you would almost think with the success that they saw in the National Hockey League of, joining forces and having American teams play Canadian teams, and they're having, you know, trouble finding some partners to want to play some football. You'd almost think that they would almost suggest that maybe they join the NFL. I don't think it was that difficult to join the NFL in the 30s. Even I think there were still, you know, some open ways to get in there, especially a big city like Toronto. I'm sure, you know, George Halas and the rest of the guys would have been excited to have a big city like that joining up in the NFL. I wonder why they didn't pursue that.
Well, maybe, but you know, it was kind of a Canadian nationalism thing. You know, there was a lot of pushback against bringing in Americans, you know, like they were doing at the time, yet under the table. I mean, it was a big controversy that they were bringing in those Americans. And so that's one of the things that I cover in my book, is about how they were bringing up these Americans into Canada and what did that mean exactly? Because they had this love-hate relationship with having the Americans play on their teams. And I mean, even today we're seeing controversy with the whole thing, because, you know, there's still rules that they have to have so many Canadians on their teams in the CFL. And right now the Players Association up there in Canada they're threatening to strike, because now as we speak, the CFL has said they're thinking about getting rid of the rule that they have to have so many Canadians on their team. And so it's been a long controversy, hot button issue up there in Canada with their football teams.
Yeah. And the whole thing with the talks with the XFL and everything, I'm sure that doesn't help, and going to four downs, and you know, I'm sure that strikes the ire of Canadian football fans everywhere. And it's such an interesting game to observe as an American. You know, I live close to the border too, so I've been a little bit familiar with Canadian football from watching, you know, broadcasts from London and Toronto. It's just over Lake Erie from where I'm at. And you can see some of the Canadian games in the summertime before the NFL season starts. I watched it as a kid a few times. The strike years, they had some games on. And it was just, it's a fascinating brand of football. But again, like we said earlier, it's a whole different strategy playing with three downs instead of, you know, the four downs like we're used to. And it's very interesting to watch, that's for sure.
And it's refreshing in some ways, right? Because it's like, it's something else, right? It's not, it's different than, you know, trying to watch this new USFL or trying to watch the XFL, because there, it's just more four down football, right? But when you watch the CFL, you're watching something that's different, right? It's only three downs. And so it just, and the field's different and all that. And so it just changes the game, and it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's great because the, you know, the passing, you know, it's more pass happy, which the NFL is sort of, in college football has gone to nowadays. But back in the 70s and 80s, you know, when it was more balanced or maybe even a little more run heavy in American football, they don't have that option, because, you know, you have to get that first down in really two downs. So you have to gain some chunks of yardage right off the bat. You can't have get stuffed at the line on a run like you can in American football. So makes a interesting twist.
And I think the pro record for the most yards passing in a game is still up in Canada. And it was Matt Dunnigan who had a game, and I can't remember how much more, but it was over 700 yards passing in one game.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a couple of good games by an NFL quarterback, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, hey, that's a great segue. This is a great book that folks, you really got to get your hands on. RC, why don't you share with us once again what your website is, where people can find more information on buying the book Border Boys?
Yep. So it's borderboysbook.com. Lots of information there. And any kind of interviews and stuff I've done, I have it on there if you want to listen to more. But also, the main publisher is Amazon. So if you go to Amazon and look up Border Boys, in books, you should be able to find it there. But it's also, like I said, it seems like it's everywhere else now too, in the online, realm.
Okay. And it's, definitely will do that. And before I let you go, do you have any, current or future projects that you're working on that maybe you can fill us in on, so we know what to expect next from RC Christensen?
Well, I'm I'm looking into more in this region. So I'm looking into more football that that happened in Minnesota, trying to figure out what I'm going to write about exactly. But I'm doing a lot of research.
Okay. Well, as soon as you have something where you're going to publish, you know, please let us know. And we'd love to talk to you again, because this is such an interesting subject of, you know, the game that's, you know, we said two countries that are side by side share in the, you know, the incubacy of this great game of turning, you know, soccer and rugby into this brands of football that are so different from each other, but yet so similar, and have a passionate fans on both sides of the border. So RC, we appreciate you joining us here talking about that, and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Thanks for having me on. You have a great podcast, and I hope folks enjoy it.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck, because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.